This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. 2 weeks ago, I read a wonderful short piece from the book How to Be a Good Creature by Cy Montgomery about her trip to French Guiana and learning all about tarantulas. If you missed it, you can find it at WDRT.org in the archive podcasts. I'm going to read again about spiders this time. Margaret Renkel, who writes a column for the New York Times, has written about her spider in her window, and I thought it would be fun for you to hear this. Margaret Renkel is a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times, reports from Nashville on flora, fauna, politics, and culture in the American South. Her last name is spelled R-E-N-K-L, and this is from December 1. I was sure our window spider was long gone. This year, the first hard freeze came nearly 3 weeks earlier than last year's, and most orb weavers aren't built to survive the winter. They hatch in spring, grow up in summer, lay eggs in fall, and die with the first freeze. Year after year, the pattern persists, and there is no use hoping it were otherwise. What is a life anyway? Charlotte asks Wilbur in E.B. White's classic children's book about friendship between a spider and a barnyard piglet. We're born, we live a little while, we die. As befits a creature who lives by liquefying the insides of insects and then sipping them dry, Charlotte is unsentimental about the matter, even as she nears death herself. I'm more like Wilbur than Charlotte. I cannot be so sanguine about the death of the spider who shares my own small ecosystem. Last summer, she pitched her deadly little camp in the space between the glass and the screen of the window next to my husband's side of the bed. I worried about her from the moment I spied her there back in July, as Annie Dillard's bathroom spider did in Holy the Firm. Our spider chose, quote, a place where there is, I would have thought, scant traffic, unquote. What flying or crawling thing would try to breach the screen in front of a closed window? Last year's late freeze seemed like a fluke, tying for the latest first freeze in Nashville's history, but there's really no way to say any kind of weather is a fluke anymore. November temperatures were still in the 70s while I packed for a trip a few weeks ago, but a hard freeze was predicted for the following night. I knew my canny companion in the window, who had been doing fine all summer and fall in her unlikely lair, would be gone by the time I got home again. After nightfall, I took one last look at the mystery of her through the dirty glass. When she meets Wilbur in Zuckerman's barn, E.B. White's spider introduces herself as Charlotte A. Cavatica. Her name includes her species ID, for the barn spider's binomial name is Araneus Cavaticus. Our bedroom spider, by contrast, has been a puzzle to me from the beginning. I have pored over field guides, including Sarah Rose's entrancing Spiders of North America, which clocks in at 611 lavishly illustrated pages. I have clicked around on websites dedicated to Southeastern and Tennessee spiders. I have searched iNaturalist entries for spiders tagged to Nashville locations. Still, I cannot for the life of me determine the species of the spider who goes about her murderous work approximately 1 foot from my husband's sleeping head. Who is she? One reason I cannot identify her is that I cannot see her very well. It has been some years since anyone has washed our bedroom windows. Spiders are doing important work in this small habitat, and I don't wish to disturb them or risk destroying their egg sacs after they die. My husband would prefer to clean these windows and all the other spidery windows of this house. I prefer spiders to cleanliness, and my preference carries the day because it is more humane and also requires no work. But dusty, rain-spotted glass does not yield the best possible view of a small creature who is attempting to hide. It doesn't matter whether I know her name. She will be who she is, whether I can name her or not. The Earth would be in much better shape if our species had not spent more than 100,000 years claiming dominion over every living thing we could slap a name on. Nevertheless, I have spent months trying to answer this question, because knowing this spider's name might help me solve the mystery of her resemblance and lack of resemblance to a similar-sized spider who took up a similar post last year and built a similar-looking little house for herself. Like the hidey hole made by last year's spider, this year's spider, Bower, is also made of oak catkins tied together with spider silk and decorated sparingly with the exoskeletons of her insect victims. When I found last year's spider crouching in a little house of her own making, I was astonished. Nobody I asked about it had ever seen such a thing either, including the naturalist and author Joanna Brichetto, who spends even more time studying household spiders than I do. We both thought we might be looking at some bit of creativity or problem solving that's unique to an individual spider. But here was a new spider, a year later, doing something very close to the same thing, in the same window. "You won't even believe this," I texted Jo. Her first thought, and mine, was that this is a daughter of last year's spider. Same window, same body type, same striped legs. Most crucially, this spider had built herself a nearly identical hideaway. She had not, however, built herself the same sort of web. Last year's orb weaver made a new web each night and ate it up again at dawn the next day. I rarely saw the web because I take care not to bother spiders while they work. It therefore took me some time to notice that this new spider was not building an orb-shaped web at all. This year's web is multidimensional, but it's not a cobweb spider's web, like the one made by the spider she shares the window with. Jo sent me some pictures of a tangle web spider in her own window, a spider who has also built a hiding place of detritus. But neither the spider nor the hiding place looks like the setup in the window on my husband's side of the bed. 2 weeks after my trip, when I could finally bring myself to check the window again, I was astonished anew. The spider had survived the first hard freeze of the year after all. She has kept up her merciless work ever since. I don't know how. She has grown up between window glass and window screen, and now she is trapped there, unable to find shelter under fallen leaves or deep in a brush pile. The cobweb spider she shares the window with escapes into a crack in the windowsill mortar. But she herself is too large for such an option. Winter won't hold off forever, and when it comes, she will be gone. This is how a rightly functioning ecosystem works. I'll miss her terribly anyway. She set up camp last summer, and we have lived together since, her with her tiny collection of insect legs, and me with my peering eyes and puzzled mind. She is like no other spider I have ever known. E.B. White's Charlotte was famously unique, but so is she, and so was last year's spider, too. I'm beginning to think maybe we all are. And that's the end of Margaret Renkel's article, her piece in the New York Times from December 1st. I want to say, hear, hear, to keeping dirty windows. I know I certainly do. Not just for spiders, but for birds and bird strikes. And if they're not dirty enough, well, I don't rely on dirt for my windows and birds. I put up netting. I put up things that hang in front. I put up cloth strips. I put up parachute cord hanging down from screws that are maybe 2 inches apart. There are all kinds of ways to keep birds from hitting your windows. And oh, is it ever important to do that? So hear, hear for dirty windows. And this year on September 1st, Margaret Renkel wrote a piece about purple martins that gather in huge flocks in Nashville on their southward migration. They're so few and far between around us. many people remember them in large numbers from when they were kids in the 50s and 60s. They're the big swallows that nest in marten houses, often thought to be necessary to locate a marten house along rivers, but a lot of people remember them inland in people's backyards, away from water bodies. It would be fun to get a hold of a marten house and see if you have any luck. I see them over at Lansing. I've been seeing them in summer, of course, over the Mississippi. A few, never very many. But Margaret Renkel wrote an article about purple martens in huge numbers, and this is pretty interesting, pretty fun, to realize that there's places where you can see lots and lots of purple martens. So here's what she has to say about that. The first sign of fall I wait for most eagerly, the one that fills my heart with outrageous hope, is the great gathering of purple martens in downtown Nashville. These birds, North America's largest swallow, have been coming here for years. Sometimes they use an old roost site. Sometimes they choose a new spot. In the United States, purple martens nest mainly east of the Rockies and spend winters in South America. They are avian acrobats feasting on flying insects while in flight themselves. When it's time to prepare for the fall migration, they gather in extravagant numbers at sites known as staging grounds. Nashville's roost is one of the largest, hosting 100,000 birds or more each year. Beginning in late June, volunteers from local conservation organizations like BirdSafe Nashville, Nashville Urban Bird, the Nature Conservancy in Tennessee, and the Tennessee Environmental Council start looking for signs that the birds have chosen this year's roost site. Last year, it was the trees in a parking lot at the Tennessee Titans Stadium. This year, they're roosting near the convention center. Neither is what you might think of as ideal bird habitat. Chattering people crowd the sidewalks. Country music pours from every open door and rooftop bar. Neon pulses on sign after sign. And yet, around 7:20 p.m., purple martens start circling high above the city, returning from their daytime foraging. As their numbers increase, they begin to circle lower and lower, a funnel cloud made of birds. By the time they start landing in the trees, they are flying low enough that you can feel the rush of their wings. There's no way to know for sure why the birds so often choose to join us in our most flagrant human absurdity, right in the heart, in a tourist district. But if you think about it, it makes a kind of sense. Purple martens are cavity nesters by nature, setting up their nurseries in woodpecker holes in dead trees. But in the eastern United States, purple martens have lost most of their natural nesting sites because of habitat destruction. They survive because people put up marten houses, multi-unit nest boxes built to serve as avian apartment buildings. In other words, virtually all the birds swooping in to sleep in Nashville's sidewalk trees were hatched and grew up in proximity to human beings. Maybe they feel a sense of security around us, a feeling that they are protected from predators by our very presence. God knows there are plenty of people hanging out in downtown Nashville. It's possible to see the birds' choice of roost sites as an irony. Human beings who are responsible for the purple martens' loss of habitat are also responsible for their survival. I prefer to think of it instead as a parable. These birds are proof of what is yet possible when many people seek a way to compensate for the wide-scale environmental destruction that our species is responsible for. Putting up a birdhouse will in no way lessen the devastation of extreme weather, which poses a huge risk to migrating birds. And it is not even a first step in repairing the devastation of habitat loss and fragmentation, but as we watch our elected officials roll back hard-won progress at a shocking and demoralizing rate, the martens tell us that we aren't wholly inadequate to this monumental task. While we are waiting for sanity to return to our government, there are measures we can take collectively and individually. Let's start with migratory birds. Turn off outdoor lights. More than half the bird species in North America are migratory. and most migratory birds undertake their journeys at night. Artificial nighttime lights confuse birds, drawing them in and then making it nearly impossible for them to escape. That's why the September 11 memorial lights are temporarily turned off when volunteers spot a huge number of birds trapped in the beams. That's why the lights illuminating the Gateway Arch in St. Louis are turned off altogether during the peak migration months of September and May. We can do the same at home. With lights that can't be safely turned off, you can at least dim them, put them on timers, or install hoods or shields that direct their light downward instead of into the sky. Make windows visible to birds. To a bird, glass doesn't register as a solid object. It's a mirror reflecting the sky and surrounding vegetation, or it's nothing at all, an open portal to another place. Both illusions lead to dead birds by the hundreds of millions. Bird-safe windows and doors are manufactured in a way that makes glass visible to birds, but unless you're building a new structure or upgrading an older one, the next best thing is to coat the glass with a substance that birds can see. Officials at Lakeside Center at McCormick Place, a notorious bird killer in Chicago, treated the building's glass with a grid of small, closely spaced dots that renders the glass visible to birds. This simple measure has reduced bird fatalities by 95%. You could mark the outside of a window with a grid painted in tempera or drawn with soap or install screens or hang ribbons from the tops of windows or invest in one of the many affordable products meant to prevent window strikes. Keep cats leashed or indoors. Domestic cats are an introduced species, not a form of wildlife. They hunt even when they aren't hungry. Cats are responsible for the deaths of some 2.4 billion birds each year. Keeping them inside year-round or leashing them when they go outdoors could save many wild lives. That's particularly true during migration season when birds are already exhausted. Make your yard safe for birds. Migratory birds must find food where they land. Bird feeders can help, but they need to be kept scrupulously clean to prevent transmission of illness. Better solutions: plant native flowers and let them go to seed. Plant native trees and shrubs that produce nuts, berries, and drupes. Swear off pesticides that kill insects and herbicides that poison food sources. Maybe all this seems like a lot of trouble for measures that will hardly touch the troubles faced by migrating birds, indeed by all wildlife. Every change you make can make a difference to the wildlife that surrounds you. Don't believe me? Come to Nashville and stand at the corner of Representative John Lewis Way and Korean Veterans Boulevard at sundown. Turn your face up to the sky. Feel the rush of wings. And that's Margaret Renkel writing in the New York Times, September 1. I feel like a soul sister to Margaret. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you so much for listening.